All right, today's sermon topic, I want to go through Job, the book of Job today, and the concept of going through the wilderness is the title, Job Through the Wilderness today. You know, when you look at the desert by the numbers around this world, you know, what a desert is you know, something that generally doesn't receive a lot of rain. Usually it's, you know, less than 16 inches of rain per year. And if you look around this Earth's surface, you know, roughly one-third of the surface, you wouldn't think that, but roughly one-third of the Earth's surface is covered in deserts, right? In the original meaning, when this word came out or when it was originally constructed, it means an abandoned place. You know, it's a place that's abandoned, deserted, if you want to think of it like that. You know, and there's even places that are, you know, ice-free regions of the Arctic and the Antarctic are known as polar deserts as well. Right, and then around 20% of the deserts on the earth are covered in sand. Right, there is an also thing that's called a cold desert, or that's ones that are kind of covered in ice and snow at times. But there's also the concept of a hot desert, and the largest hot desert in this world is the Sahara. And that one covers or spans 12 different countries. It's a massive, massive thing. You know, and I was watching a show, and some of these deserts are absolutely so hot that the little animals have trouble actually walking on the sand because it's so blistering hot. I was watching one documentary, this little lizard that it would walk and it would stop the, you know, back right foot, front left foot, put on the ground, and the other ones it would just stick in the air like this for a little bit because it had to let them cool off. And then it would walk a little bit and then it would do the opposite. And these would be sticking in the air like that. By the way, it's the first lizard gesture I've done in a sermon, so you're welcome. And then even some of the snakes in this desert, you know, they'll bury themselves underneath the sand because it's just so blistering hot. You know, in these deserts, if you ever see movies or you ever see cartoons, you know, a lot of times people get lost in the deserts and they end up wandering around. Some people find their way out, some don't, you know, because it gets so hot. It gets so fatiguing that you can easily die, get dehydrated. It's the number one thing. And then people see mirages and it's just the heat will get to people. You know, when you think about this concept of a desert or an abandoned place, there's periods in life, sometimes for us, that you can only describe, you know, as wilderness or desert years, wilderness years. That's wilderness of your spirit, your soul, things in life. And that can come from a number of different things. It could come from, you know, the death of a loved one. You could lose your job. It could come from a betrayal. You know, and it's just any scenario in life where your soul, your spirit is stretched thin, where you feel alone, and where you end up wandering around. And you wonder why, these times of great stress. You know, when we look at this, there's stages to a wilderness. There's stages to going through a desert or this wilderness times and the wilderness periods. And there's a progression through it. And the hardest part of this whole progression is sometimes being in the wilderness and feeling like God is gone or God is not there. And you cry out and you wonder and you ask all of the questions. And we see this. Turn back to Psalm 77, verse 1. You know, I'll just read a couple of these. But you can read the description of what a wilderness period of life feels like. You know, David wrote this. There's other ones that were written in the Bible as well. But there was one particular here in Psalm 77, verse 1. It says, I cried out to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God, and I was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. It's a characteristic, being overwhelmed, being overdone. The water is coming up over your head. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times, and I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. In verse 7, will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? These are the questions. In a wilderness period, these are the questions. These are the things that we tend to ask. These are the things that tend to come out and we wrestle with. These are the types of questions that we wrestle with. Has God left me? Has he forsaken me? What is he angry? What happened? What happened here? And then the other question that we ask is, how long is this going to go on? And I'll just quote Psalms 13. It says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long? That's another question that we always ask. And we see the characteristics of being in the wilderness period. And I don't mean just, hey, I just had a hard week. I mean periods in your life that may feel empty, destitute, that may feel difficult. Maybe you haven't had one for a long time. Maybe you haven't had some big ones. But, you know, there are those that do. There are those that are sit among us that have these long wilderness periods. And it's important for us to understand that. And if you're not going through one, how do we interact with someone who might be going through one? And for those who are going through a wilderness period, how long? Why? Why is this happening? Has God left me or forsaken me? These are the three questions we always ask. Why? Why did I do something wrong? How long is this, you know, when is this going to end? Why does it just seem to keep going? And has God left me? It feels like God leaves me sometimes. Why is that? Those are the questions that you ask in the wilderness years. Those are the types of things that you grapple with. There's a quote by Zora Neale Hurston. It says, there are years that ask questions, and there are years that answer them. And the wilderness years are the years that make you ask the questions. Let's turn back to Job 1. No one in the Bible has embodied being in the wilderness more than the man Job. You know, and I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from this. We've covered some of this at different points throughout the years, but let's go through a few more things and understand both the question of you when you ask, why is this happening? How long is it going to take place? And has God left me? These are all things that are in the book of Job as well. Let's find out a couple things. Job 1, verse 1. You know, we find this is a description of a great scene. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And so, first off, when we talk about the book of Job, and I hear people say, oh, you know, Job was self-righteous and all these other things. It's not what the Bible says at all. In fact, God is saying that this was a blameless and upright man, and he feared God and he shunned evil. God's declaring him that. Only God can do that. That wasn't Job saying Job did that. God says this about him. So that's a very important thing to understand. This guy was trying to do the right thing constantly. And he had 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him, and he had a ton of stuff. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 3 Lamborghini Aventadors, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So, you know, this man was a great man in the place, in the time, in the era, in the East. So what would happen is his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day. They would send out invitations and the 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. He would rise early, offer sacrifices according to the number of them. Says, maybe they sinned, I don't know. So Job was very diligent. He was very diligent with his family, very diligent trying to obey and worship God. And we see this picture. We see this picture in his life. And you know what? We think this sometimes, this equation which we, you know, if we just obey, we'll be blessed. And that's must be the equation that is the only thing that underpins our life. If I obey, then I'm blessed. I obey, then I'm blessed. And we see this picture of Job being blessed. But you know what? Wilderness years can come suddenly, and they did here. They can come without warning. They can come out of left field. They can come from places you don't know, you don't expect, and they can be devastating. But what we find here is it's very important to set the stage that there's actually an upper stage, one that's in heaven that you don't see, where God exists and lives, and then there's a lower stage that's us, what you see down here on earth. And you don't know what's always happening in the upper stage. Let's read that, Job 1, verse 6. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came. And the Lord said to Satan, you know, from where do you come? You know, God has to tease this out of him. Satan's, you know, you just hear his language. It's just such a squirrely, non-taking responsibility victim. Where do you come? Oh, I'm just going from around the earth, walking back and forth, you know. Absolutely not. He's out trying to pin people down and destroy them. And that's what he does. And the Lord said to him, well, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? He's a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So God, those are God's words about Job. So Was self-righteousness his problem? It was not. God declared him this. That's the only one who could say that. And he said that about Job. And then verse 9, so Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all those he has on every side? You blessed the work of his hands, his possessions have increased, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said, okay, go do that, but don't touch him as a person. And so he went out and from the presence of the Lord. And, you know, this is the argument. This is the argument that Satan says to God. The only reason that you are here is because God is blessing you. The only reason is because God gave you a job. God gave you a house. God gave you a car. It's the only reason you would obey God. You know, if all those things disappear, would you still obey God? That's the basic argument he just said about Job. And God said, okay, well, let's go look at that. And then so all this took place, and I'll just skip over it, but, you know, his kids all died all at once and, you know, lost everything that he had. And in verse 20, what we find is Job arose, tore his robe, and he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. First reaction, and he said, naked, I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. And the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Right? And this is how he responded at the beginning. I mean, he lost his entire family. That's pretty devastating if you think about that. Everything. And he stops and he still tries to keep doing the right thing. You know, this is the argument that Satan says again, that if we stop receiving blessings from God, we'll stop obeying him. Is that our thinking? You know, is it like, I don't know about you, but when I was young, you know, when the ice cream truck would come around the neighborhood, you know, you hear that tune, you get so excited, you know, and you run to your parents and, you know, can I have $1.50? And they'd be like, nope, or yes, and, you know, I want to go get one of those orange push-ups. I used to love those orange push-up things, whatever they were. Super healthy, but hey, anyway, they were so good. I didn't really care. They were so good. So, you know, on a hot day, it was great. But, you know, do we look at God like an ice cream truck? You know, oh, yeah, love to see it come around. We're going to get some good stuff, and that's all it's about. This is what Satan was saying. That's the only reason they're with you, God, because look what you did to him. And that was a conversation that was there. Is Satan baiting God? Is he, hey, you know, well, got you in an argument, got you to react? What we'll find is, it's actually super interesting, even though this conversation is going on, God's constantly in this dialogue proving Satan wrong, but the whole events that were happening and the result of this whole process was something way bigger. And actually did really good for Job. So when Satan started, he didn't realize it's actually going to work out better for Job. And he's probably like, oh, foiled again. But, you know, it's not just this petty argument happening here. God's doing something even bigger here. But God says, no, we can, let's play this out. And then we go to chapter 2. So Satan comes back and he says, you know, so chapter 2, verse 2, you know, where do you come? Satan says, well, I was just walking around again, just walking back and forth on the earth, you know, just wandering around. And he said, look, hey, have you considered Job? Look at Job over there, right? And then verse 4, it says skin for skin. Yeah, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. He's like, okay, go for it. And so Satan went out and he struck him with painful boils all over his body, right? And he had to have a potsherd, you know, a broken piece of pot, like a flower pot, and he had to scrape his skin off, you know. He was in such pain. And he had to sit in the ashes. It was so tender. The only place he could do is, you know, some soft ashes. So this guy is now, goes from all the stuff covered in ashes with all these festering wounds, and he's scraping himself with a pot. This is, that life is a little bit of a turn right there. And then we see in verse 9, his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. You know, it's probably not encouraging, but, you know, Job's wife always gets dumped on. But let's not dump on Job's wife. I mean, stop and think about this for 2 seconds. She just lost all of her children, all of her families, all of her stuff. Not one, but all of them at once, all of the things she had. And now it looks like her husband's sick and he'll die. And in those days, in those ages, in that time, if you were, you know, husbandless, you would be less than nothing. You'd be destitute. You'd be in poverty, basically, is the way it was set up back then. So they had, you know, went from that to this, and she's just expressing it. She's just expressing it. We see Job later expressing a bunch of stuff here. right? And that's not wrong. It's not wrong to express, you know. She's just kind of lashing out at that. So, you know, just think about that for a second. And then he said, you know, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? Shall we not accept adversity? And in all this, Job did not sin. But we see Job start to struggle. And this is one of the characteristics of going through a wilderness time in life, is struggle and starting to struggle. And he begins to question things and struggle with his understanding of how things work and what's going on and what happened. And you begin to examine what you know about God. That's what started to happen here. How do I really understand how this is? How God works? Do I fully get this? You know, what's going on here? And you struggle, you grapple with this. And this is an interesting thing about being in the wilderness. And this is something God deliberately takes us through. God here deliberately took him through this period of time. And he watched him struggle through all of this. And that's a natural part of when you go through this. Now, his friends came along. Job 2, verse 11. His three friends, you know, heard of all of this. And they came, each from his own place, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. And then they made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head towards heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and not one spoke a word to him, for they saw the grief was very great. Boy, they didn't recognize him. That's pretty devastating to where he had come to. When his friends saw him, they had no idea who he was. He was so disfigured and all messed up and bleeding and all the rest of the stuff. And he used to be this powerful person down to this destitute person. And when they came to sympathize and they saw him, they're overwhelmed. They didn't say anything. That's a powerful act, actually. They started out really good in this whole process. You know, it's called Shiva. Sitting seven. You sit and mourn with someone for a week. And they did this. And you didn't say anything. That's a super powerful act if you want to think about that, of coming to sit with someone and be with someone and not say anything, but just sit and mourn with them. And they started out really good. That's a good thing. They should have kept their mouths closed, is the thing here with what they were saying. But you know what? It's also good that they spoke. Because what they said are all the arguments you're going to hear when you go through the wilderness, right? So the conversations that were there are things that people say about you, or you say in your head about you, or whoever gets said, are the things when someone's going through the wilderness. You know, and this is important to think about, this sitting seven days and not speaking. Sometimes that's what you should do. I'm not going to say 7 days, but you don't have to say anything. You know, a lot of times we come in when there's somebody going through a tremendous grief and we want to fix it. Here's the solution. You know, I've got a problem. Have you done this? Have you tried this? And don't underestimate the power of just being with someone without a word being said, right? A lot of times people do isolate themselves when they're going through these times and they cut their social ties and they go fall back into, you know, bad things. And it's important to reach out to them on these type of things. Right, but sometimes you don't have to say anything. Don't try to fix it. You know, and I find that that is a hard concept. Think about this for a second. Is even this sermon, you're probably sitting there going like, man, this is a heavy one. Why didn't you give me some nice, you know, positive thing today to talk about? We're talking about something that's about trials. But you know what? Sometimes we have to sit, let them sit with us and think through these things. And when you sit with somebody going through something, it's not comfortable. It can be awkward. It can be hard. But, you know, carry that. Sit there with that. That's a powerful thing. Learn to not have to try to fix it. Learn to just be there to start with. So they started out really, really well when they sat with him for 7 days. That's great. That's super great. You know, people with strong connections and scientifically are less susceptible to colds and viruses. You know, scientifically, they produce less mucus. That's a fact. I actually wrote it down. So that means unfriendly people are snottier than friendly people. Trying to keep you guys awake today, but that was a great laugh. So we don't have to have the answers, though. You know, but you know what? Being there for someone and those connections is a super important thing. Paul said, "Mourn with those who mourn, weep with those who weep." He didn't say give advice to them to how to fix it necessarily. So that's an important thing. It's a very important thing for us, right? Their words weren't so hot later, but their silence was brilliant. And God says, you know, feed me, you know, when I'm thirsty, give me a drink. Those are things that are of service. Those are things of being there. Those are of when somebody's going through something. It's not just the words. It's the things that you do to somebody. That's the sheep and the goats. There's a difference between them. Right? Has somebody ever made you a meal when you're in a crisis? That's bringing somebody a cup of cold water or food when they're hungry. And that's a super important thing, right? Those are big things. Now, what happens next is that Job was in grappling with this, but it still wasn't fully there. Now he gets to a point where the waters, you know, are right here, his nose is up, and then, boom, they go over his head. And that's Job chapter 3, verse 1. It says, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth, and Job spoke. So now he's letting it out. May the day perish in which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine on it. May darkness and shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for the night, may darkness seize it. May it not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come into the numbers of the month. This is talking about his birthday, his day of birth. Black it out. Make it dark. Take it off the calendar. Get rid of the number. You know, this is what he's saying. May those that curse it, verse 8, who curse the day, those are ready to rouse Leviathan. May the stars in the morning be dark, blah, 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 blah. Why did I not die at birth, he says in verse 11. Why did I not perish when I came out of the womb? Why did the knees receive me, blah, blah. You know, he's just going. He opens his mouth. He's only getting warmed up. He's only getting warmed up. You know, and the point of this is that a person going through true wilderness, at some point, will break or open their mouth and say some things that don't sound so good. So what? You know, he's struggling with this. You know, a true friend, even though tempted, won't leave. Don't have to tell him, you know, not say. Like, Job is just expressing extreme grief here. And it's important for us to understand that this is when somebody's truly being pressed through the wilderness, we'll say some stuff. They may not sound so great. And you'll go, wow, that sounds a little negative or a little hard. But you know what? That's part of the process sometimes. Have you ever, you know, if you can fully keep it together, you're probably not fully in a wilderness here. Sometimes you'll crack. Not necessarily in public, but you might crack at times. And that's what he's doing. He cracked. The veneer fell off. The waters went over his head. It became too much, and he unraveled a bit here, right? So that's a sign of being pressed. And he cracks, and he's going to say some things. And you know what? He says a lot of things in this chapter that are very interesting. But that's part of the process. And just remember that. You know, a lot of times we want to, like, you know, don't say that. Don't think that. Don't be that. It's like somebody's grieving. They might say things that are hard because that's where they're at. But what comes next in here is the next phase. So you start to grapple is one of the first phases. Then he gets to a place where it's like being in a desert. You start wandering around. You start wandering around emotionally. Verbally, your words, their thoughts, your things. And that's kind of the next phase. Hold your place in Job and turn to Psalms 102. What does it feel like to wander? It's perfectly summed up in Psalms 102. We'll go back to Job, but Psalms 102, verse 2. David says, "Do not hide your face from me in the day of my trouble. Incline your ear to me in the day that I call. Answer me speedily, for my days are consumed like smoke. And my bones are burned like a hearth. My heart is stricken and withered like grass, so that I forgot to eat." He's forgetting to eat. My heart is stricken and withered like grass. I'm not even eating. "Because the sound of my groaning, my bones cling to my skin." So he stopped eating. He's getting very emaciated. "I'm like a pelican in the wilderness. I'm like an owl of the desert." You know, when I was alone, and in a sparrow alone, these are all thoughts about being alone. You know, when I was young, we'd always sing this song. And I'd always laugh because I'm like, why am I singing about a pelican and an owl? Like, I can't relate to this at all. Like, I'm like a pelican. That song we sing, I'm not going to sing it for you because I can't sing. So, but it's a pelican and an owl and a sparrow. These are all birds that are describing usually in a solitary place. Pelican in the wilderness and owl in the desert. So he's just expressing through the animal world that he's alone. This is what it feels like. You completely feel like you're alone. "My enemies reproach me all day long. They deride me. For I've eaten ashes like bread and mingled my drink with weeping and crying. Because of your indignation and your wrath, you've lifted me up and cast me away. My days are like a shadow, and I wither away like the grass." That's what it feels like, emotionally, physically. Stop eating. You're crying. You feel alone. Your bones are getting dried up. You feel just really, really brittle, really, really hollow, and barely making it. And that's the place that he's in. Now, let's turn back to Job. It's a description of what it feels like. In Job, you'll see him go through a lot of the same things where he felt here. You know, then the next 28 chapters, we won't read them, but someday read them, because in the next 28 chapters, Job pours out bitterness and confusion. You know, why is this happening? And guess what his friend's basic argument is, all of them? What does it come down to that they're saying? Yeah, you must be doing something wrong. You must have done something wrong. You must. And back and forth this goes for 28 chapters. Why is it good to read that? Because a couple of things. Just look at Job 8, verse 4. They say this. You know, if your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away because they sinned. Right? So how many people have you heard the argument, oh, they probably were celebrating birthdays and God killed them for it or something like that. Guess what? This is what the friends said. So why is it good to read their arguments? Because we say them and we shouldn't. Okay, to Job, we say things like that. Well, you know, maybe there was a sin there and it was just hidden. And so God, boom, struck them down. That was the argument that the friend said about Job. And what was the reaction of Job? He wasn't saying, oh, we're sinless. He was saying, I'm sorry, this is devastating. Why are you saying that? He didn't say he's sinless. He says, this is devastating. You know, sometimes we have the same thoughts. I love this quote from Phil Yancey. He says, people who make suffering people worse are Christians. It's a great quote. Think about that for a second. Why is that? Because sometimes when you see somebody wandering in the wilderness, we come in and we moralize to them or give them a quick fix. Why? Because you're uncomfortable. That's what I said. It's very important to think about, can you figure out how to be uncomfortable with somebody without saying anything? Could you do that? You know, we say things, oh, you know, all you need to do is have faith, or, you know, maybe you've sinned and maybe God's just showing you something. And every single thing the friends said are arguments we say to people. That's why it's really good at some point to dissect, go through their arguments and go, do I sound like any of these guys here? There were three guys. Do I sound like these guys at all? Hey, maybe there's something hidden. Hey, you know, then that was the basic gist of what they said. Because if you do, we'll find out later, God came to those three guys, and what did he say? He says, you have not spoken of me correctly. He completely reprimanded everything that they were saying to Job. And that's why it's important. That's why this is actually written here, right? This is written down so that you and I can see these type of arguments that come out that we might actually use, and God says those are not correct. You and I don't know what's happening on this upper stage. His friends didn't know. They can only see the lower stage. They didn't know what's happening up here. It's very important for us to be careful with judgment about somebody's situation. How quick we conclude about why this happened or what happened. Passing judgment of any type is the problem. We're attributing causes to things that we think are the problem. You know what that's doing? You are taking the place of God, who is in control of this up here. And you are sitting yourself in that place going, eh, it's probably because of this, and you're saying it to the person or to other people and attributing some judgment. You don't know what's happening on the stage up here. Would you ever have guessed, if you saw this, Job, of what's happening up in heaven in that whole dialogue? You never would in your entire life have figured that out. But God wrote it down for us so that we know that type of thing happens, so that you and I can go, hey, I don't know what's going on there, but something, God knows about this. God's involved with this. And when we pass judgment, I mean, when somebody dies from cancer, we don't say they didn't eat the right thing, or somebody's healed, or it's because of herb. We don't know what's happening in this upper room up here, and you're putting yourself in the place of that. Or somebody's born with disabilities, you know, it was the mom's fault, or whatever. Didn't eat right, or you didn't take care of yourself. Or if we put judgment on something like that, we are doing what the friends did. We are doing what Job's three friends did, and it's super wrong. God was mad at them. God was mad at the three friends. We can read it later, but don't say things like that to people. Don't even put it in your head. You don't know what's going up in the heavenly realm. You don't know what conversation is happening. And we'll find that, you know, we'll find later, like, how God works. It's super interesting for us to understand. So those 28 chapters are every possible argument that you can make that are humanistically and that we have said in the past or we have said before to people and we should never say again. And we should read those to stay away from those type of arguments. You know, God says not one hair of your head will fall without him knowing it. If the concept was understood back in those days or down through the ages, he could have said this differently. Not one molecule in your body will be changed with cancer without me knowing it. Or not one DNA strand is going to be altered without me knowing it. They wouldn't know what that meant back then. He said hairs, which is one of the most numerous things that you could see on the body. Not one of those will fall without him knowing it. So if somebody is sick and somebody is something, God knows about it. God is sitting up here and we don't know what conversation's happening up there. So when we pass judgment, we act like the three friends. That's why it's written for us. That's why there's 28 chapters of that. We skip over them because they're boring or they get tiring. But please read them and keep asking yourself, do I talk like these people? And let's not talk like those people. Chapter 6, verse 14. Job says this. Great, great, great scripture. To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. He says, I don't need your moralizing. I need your mercy. Even if it looks like my words are turning away from God, even if it looks like I'm struggling, even if I go throw my hands up in the air at some point in time through this and go, this is too much, even if, please be kind. That's part of the progression for some people. I don't know if you've seen this before. Somebody pressed to the wall completely, and it breaks them. It breaks them, and they may say some stuff, and they may go off, or they may have a hard time with it. That's what he says. Kindness should be shown. No matter what he's saying, if I blurt out these words that sound pretty bad, please be kind. Let me work through what I'm working through. And now he's wandering. You see him wander all around. Chapter 19, verse 6. Chapter 19, verse 6. Wandering is characteristic of grappling with these arguments. One minute you're over here, one minute you're over there, now you're here, back and forth. 19, verse 6. God's wronged me. Know then that God has wronged me, and he has surrounded me with his net. Then he contradicts that right away. Verse 25 later. Well, I know my Redeemer lives and will stand on earth. I know that my Redeemer lives and he will stand at last on the earth. You know, so this is characteristic. Just think about this. Back and forth. You sound emotionally all over the map. That's wandering. And then he has a case he wants to make. Chapter 23, verse 3. You know, if I could find him, I'd present my case to him. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat, and I would present my case to him and fill my mouth with arguments. Right, so he's grappling with this, now he's wandering, and this is a characteristic. So think about it. You're going to grapple with the hard questions. You'll hold yourself together. Somebody starting out will go, yes, I have faith in God, and when it keeps going, keeps getting pressed, you'll see them start to wander, and to some point, if it overwhelms them, they'll break for a bit. That's how it worked here. That's the pattern you see here. It's important to see that. That wandering is part of the stages of going through the wilderness, part of it. Now, we see God's response in all this finally. So I'm skipping through a whole bunch of arguments, skipping through a whole bunch of things that are said. But just in summary, he's grappling. He's wandering. This is what you do in the wilderness and in a desert. And God shows up. Go to chapter 38, verse 1. God shows up, finally, through all of this, and he answers them. You know, one of the things, there's a sub-theme here. I won't go through all the scriptures. But one thing that's kind of called out here, in this chapter, is that Job finally kind of sees too about eternity and the resurrection and what God's plan has. And God was kind of taking him through this to say, oh, my children died, but they're going to be resurrected. And he shows them this and he comes to that understanding. I won't go through that, but there's a subtext if you want to study that's what comes out in this. He says, I know my Redeemer lives. He comes to this place where he gets all of these things too. But here's how God answers him. He shows up. Job 38, verse 1. The Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind. So it comes in a whirlwind, lands in this dump in the trash heap in the ashes he's sitting on. And he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurement? Surely you know, or stretched the line upon it. To what were its foundations fastened, or laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. You know, stop there for a second. It seems, whenever I read this response or read it in the past, it seems a little odd how God's responding. It's almost like he's not paying attention to what's going on here with Job. Like, hey, you're in all this pain. And he starts kind of coming in out of all of Job's questions. He starts back with a bunch of questions for him, is what he does. It seems kind of odd and unrelated and a strange reply. You know, why is God doing this? Why is he saying this? Because he's pointing something out for us of what we, in the wilderness, should focus on, the things that we should think about, the things we should dwell upon as we go through those times. Where does he start with? Oh, he starts small, right? Hey, you know, where were you when I built, first of all, the earth you're sitting on? Where were you when I laid the foundations? Do you know how far around it is? Do you know the measurements of it? Do you know the measurement to the nearest star? How about across our galaxy? How about across the solar system? How about across the whole universe? Do you know how big that is? So he starts to put his brain onto a place which is very important for us when we go through those things, for us to put our brains on too. And he starts with the smallest possible thing you could think of, which is the entire universe. Where were you when I built this, and how big is it? And what's it sitting on? What's it fastened to, etc.? So he starts asking him that. And in verse 25, who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass? You know, this is an interesting scripture. I think I read this one last week, right? To cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness where there is no man. This is an interesting statement about God and how he is. He's saying that he even waters places, and there's no one there. No one to see it, no one to receive it, but he waters it. Why is that? Because he's focusing Job's mind on, this is the type of a God that I am. I water, even when there's nobody, I still take care of it. The way that I am is I will take care of everything. I built this whole earth. I built all the things in it. Even when there's nobody, I will still put rain there and take care of it. And where does he say that rain is? Wilderness. What are we talking about here today? Is through the wilderness. When we talk about going through the wilderness, God says, you know, he's not saying that by accident. He says, even when there's a desolate wilderness, even when in your life, even when there's that, I will still water you. He's also saying that to Job. Even if it feels like there's no one there, you're alone, you're destitute, he deliberately says that there's a wilderness where there is no one, and you're on your own and you're wandering it. I will cause it to spring forth and grow of tender grass. I will still take care of it. That's a great phrase that he's saying. God's paying attention to all these areas, and he's paying attention to even when you're in the wilderness, in the hardest place. And then he keeps going on. Go to chapter 39, verse 1. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear their young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain. They depart and they don't return to them. Who set the donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of an onager? Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land its dwelling? He scorns the city. He doesn't heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is pasture. He searches for every green thing. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Will he leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? What is all this? Why is he saying all this? I always used to read that and go, this just seems, what is this response to Job? You know what's interesting about all of this? Is God is talking about just how much of a creation he's made and all the details of it and how much he pays attention to it. mean, think about that for a second. He's going through, he delights in all of his creation. I mean, he's saying all these things, man, I made this thing. And the temperament of it is it hates to be near people in the city, and it's out in the wilderness. And I gave him the pastures, and he looks for all the green stuff. And the wild ox, can you even tame that thing? That's a massive beast. That thing won't, tow for you. And his strength is great. And he starts talking about all the details of what he's created. He starts with the earth. He starts with all the things in it and all the things he's created and he's made. And he calls all the attention to the detail of every single little one of these animals, of how he made it, how they're fed, how he feeds them, how he takes care of it. Even when there's a desert, I still put rain. All these things are all he delights in his creation, and he pays attention to them. They're fed by him, and he does good to all of them at all times. You know, it's interesting, and he's calling his attention to, and he's basically saying it without saying it. Job, if I created all this, I know what's in there, I put it all together, and I'm paying attention to the detail of every single one of these animals you see around you and their personality and their characteristics, do you not think I'm paying attention to you and where you're at? That's basically what he's saying. He said, keep going in verse 13. The wings of an ostrich wave proudly, but her wings are pinions like kindly storks. For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern. Because God deprived her of wisdom, he did not endow her with understanding. We have a goofy ostrich. You know, and what does an ostrich do? They put their, when they're in trouble, they stick their head in the ground. They think they're hidden, right? And God says, look, I made her that way. Not a lot of wisdom in that beast. And God's just saying, look, have I not put together every single nuance of everything that you see around you, all these interactions, all these animals? I even made this ostrich like this, really goofy. In chapter 40, verse 15, now look at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now his strength in his hips and his power in his stomach muscles. Different speculation as to what this animal is, but most likely by the description, it's referring to a hippopotamus, one of the strongest animals. It says he moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He's the first to the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees, in covered reeds and marsh, so in the water under the trees. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth. Talking about a beast that is super strong, that lives in the water. I don't know if you've ever seen a hippo, but they're one of the strongest animals out there. And they can run, I forget what it was, like up to 35 miles an hour underwater. And they can kill you just like that. And he's saying, like, this is one of the pinnacles of my creation. I created this thing. Look at that. And he does, the most raging waters, and he's still the first of his creatures. You know, that's the first of God's creatures. We can't see that. We have no use for it. But God's saying, look, this is one of my best designs. One of the best things I made is this hippo over here. We go to the zoo and we throw carrots in their mouth and then we leave, And he's saying, look at this thing. God is creating, caring for, delighting in the animals that man has no use for. But God is good regardless. God loves regardless. God is delights in all of these things. These animals are all fed. They're all taken care of. They're all watered. It's his nature of how he is. And so what God is opening his eyes to is to put his focus back on how God really is. And if you're going through a wilderness, why don't you do what God spoke to Job? Why don't you go sit out somewhere and watch a bird in a tree, or an eagle fly, or ducks in the water, or some dog, or a cat, or an animal, or something, and watch all the things that it does, or the sparrow that's, on your roof, and it goes out and gets food for the kids, and all these other things. The God that you're going through this with knows every single little detail about those animals, and made them a certain way, and gave them a temperament and a personality, and feeds them, and clothes them, and pays attention to every detail. And not one of those birds would drop without him knowing it. So God's putting his brain back to say, if I do this, guess what, Job? I know everything here. I know all this. I know what's going on here. I've got it. I've got you. Are you kidding me? I know every single step of this. I know every single piece of this. And so we find that Job comes to the conclusion at the end, when his brain is put back on that place, And he says in chapter 42, verse 5, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And we see that Job finally got to know God on a deeper level. So let me ask you a question. So wilderness years, all this happening up here, look like a little bet, you know, God and Satan almost, and oh, Satan's tweaking, making God do something. What happened by the end here? Was God actually doing? God is actually bringing Job to a place where he saw him, God, deeper, saw him for real, saw who he really was, saw how he cared, saw all of these things about God. Do you think that's a good thing? This is the best thing you could do for somebody in their life, is to have them really see how God is, who God is, the loving character and the kindness of it. And that's what he brought him through. So while it looked like all these things that are there, God was doing something much deeper through all of this. But his answers I find fascinating. And that would be something to think about the next time you're going through the wilderness years, is to study the animals and look at it and know that God knows every single thing that's going on with those things and showing you that, man, look, everything around you, I've got in detail. I've got this too. I know you. Do you think he cares about them more than you? No. And it was an interesting way he responded to him. And so it was, verse 7, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to the friends, he says, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken to me what is right as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, go offer some offerings, and my servant Job will pray for you, for I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken to me what is right as my servant Job has. Even all the wandering and the grappling, God knew was a part of the process, but his friends, what they said to him, God really got mad at them for. Think about that. That's why I say go back and read those arguments and make sure we don't use them. Don't say them to people. And, you know, God restored all these things back to Job. We find that. And when he did that is after he prayed for his friends. That's a very interesting timing. So, yes, he was done wrong. Yes, he was made more bitter and spun up. But God wanted him to also let that go. And he prayed for the friends, and then that's when God restored all that Job had. Think about that. Even if he was done wrong by all of that. So, now, did these wilderness years end for Job? Yes, they did. Job 42, verse 12, he blessed them better. In the latter days, he had more than the beginning. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camel, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys, 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he called the name of the first, you know, etc. In all the land there were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job. And their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and grandchildren for 4 generations. He died full of age. Will your wilderness years end? Yes, they will. Some point. They will end. They will end. But it's the process in getting to the place he's bringing you to that's the most important. You know, he was restored after this. You know, there's a little phrase that's up there that's super interesting, too, about the daughters. It says their father gave them inheritance among their brothers. The boys weren't even mentioned by name here. This is interesting. The girls are. That never happens. Back in those societies, it was a, you know, male thing and an inheritance thing, and the men were, and only their lineage mostly were mentioned, but they're not mentioned. The women are mentioned here, right? Jemima means a dove, a bird of peace. Keziah means cinnamon, prized spice. They love the smell of it. Karen Hoppuck means, you know, horn of eyeshadow, or like makeup. Revlon or Maybelline is what it means. And these names are, you know, these are expressing the beauty of God's creation. So, why give them inheritance? Well, God just got done talking to him about how he, you know, delights in his creation, in all of his creatures, even the awkward ones. He loves and he made and he did on purpose. And back in those days, women were lesser. They're lesser. Didn't get inheritance, didn't get named, didn't get the thing. You know, they were lesser creatures in some way. And after listening to God, he took the same mentality God had towards all of his creatures. And he says, I love all of them. And female in those days were kind of considered less. And now he's loving regardless, caring regardless. He's generous. right? He's doing the same thing, and now he's propping up the ones that would be seen as less in the society. Can you see how he has gone from, wow, he didn't quite see God, and when he says, now I see God and how you are, and now I'm emulating that. Guess what? Here's the girls. Let's give them an inheritance. Let's prop them up. Let's make this. I love all of the creation, all the creatures, just as God does. And you see that? That's an interesting phrase. It's a really small thing to pass over, but Job truly did see God now and how he was. And now all that he does is like that. So, a couple things just to wrap this up as we get down to time. Some people are suffering. Why? Was it ever told to Job? Nope. You probably won't know. How long will it last? Don't know. Does your response matter? Yes. One thing you do know, though, that there's an upper stage and a lower stage. Right? And God knows all that is going on. When a wilderness comes, thank him. Ask him to help you. But learn that God is good. He's generous. He's always loving. You know, where is God in that wilderness? Where did he say he was? He says, I even rain you when you're in the wilderness, when there are no people, when you're alone, when you're in that desert. I will even rain you there. So what are the three questions, the answers to them? Why is this happening to me? You know, we don't know why, but we do know that it's bigger than just what you see in front of you. This is what Job teaches us. There's a stage up here and a stage down here. You don't know why. You won't know why necessarily. And the more you dwell on that question, you might not ever get it answered in this day and this age. One day you will. But you don't need to know it. God didn't come and answer that question for Job. Did he? Think about that. He didn't. Didn't feel the need to. Do you just know that Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those that love God, to those that are called according to his purpose. You don't see the upper stage? Just trust that all things will work for good. Did that happen with Job's life? You see it written there. You didn't have to know why. When will it end? I don't know. It's also the wrong question. God didn't answer it for Job. God didn't tell him through there, hey, just hang on for another month. God didn't tell him. Psalms 27:14 says, wait on the Lord and be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. And the third question we grapple with, why has God forsaken me? Sometimes it can feel like it's that way because we want answers to those first two questions. Why is this happening? When's it going to end? And God didn't answer them for Job. When we don't get those answers, we tend to wander through the wilderness asking, crying, and pleading, still no answer. And you know what God said to Job? You're asking the wrong questions. That's what he said because he gave him a different view of things to focus on. Deuteronomy 8:13. Let's turn there and we'll finish up this and one more. Deuteronomy 8:13. Ancient Israel went through the wilderness. And God said to them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness. Think about this and read this the next time you're going through something. He led them through the great and terrible wilderness, in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and a thirsty land where there was no water. And I brought you water out of a flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with food, which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you and that he might test you. And here's the phrase to remember, to do you good in the end. Every single one of those things that you go through, that God brings you through, is to do you good, not to punish you, as the friend said, or because you have a sin, but God wants to do you good. He did Job super good, did he not? That whole process was difficult, but he did it good in the end. That's what God wants to do with you. So where is God in all this? He's leading you through every step of the way, fiery serpents and all. Water, food, rain, to do you good in the end. Is it easy? Nope. It's hard. Will you find answers to the first two questions? Why is this happening to me? When will it end? Nope. And God says those are the wrong ones to answer anyway. Is he there? Every step of the way? Absolutely. Even in the desert where there is no one, when you're alone, he still will rain you and cause a bud to go. So let's focus on the right questions, or let's focus on the right things as we look at this. And let's turn to Isaiah 51, verse 3, read the final scripture. And this is the end result after we go through a wilderness of what will happen. The healing will come. The wilderness years will end. If you're in one, it will end sometime. It may go on for a long time more. Sometimes you think, hey, it's ending, and sometimes it keeps going. Isaiah 51, verse 3, for the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden, like a garden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in it, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. That is what God will do when he takes you through the wilderness. At the other end of it, it'll be like a garden. The desert will be like the garden of the Lord, and joy and gladness. That's how it works with God. You're going to have to go through it sometimes. You may have your wilderness years. If you don't, and if you see somebody else going through their wilderness years, sit with them in silence and hold that. Don't fix it and don't argue like one of Job's friends. And us, when we go through that, ask the right questions of God. Not why is this happening, when's it going to end, but put your mind on God, his creation. Look at the details outside your window and all that he does and he shows and he loves and how he works and how big the universe is, all those things. And you'll quickly realize, man, all this little kind of inward focus that I'm feeling, that I really feel, I can see God pays attention to every single detail and made every single piece of this and makes all of this work. Obviously, he's here with me. We'll get through the wilderness and there'll be healing on the other side.